This is Car Expert.
The presence and the emotion it gets out of you when you look at it and sit in it, that just makes you feel like a boss.
The Havel stuff feels like it's maybe a year or two ahead of the MGs.
Twin turbo V6 rear-wheel drive wagon, sign me up. I'd love one of these.
Well, it's just two of us for this week. Hello, William Stopford.
Hello, Mandy Turner. It's just two of us. Just the two of us.
Yes. I think this is the first Car Expert podcast we've ever done with just two of us. So
if you don't like the sound of my voice and my weird accent, I'm sorry. You're going to listen to more of it this episode.
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
How was your weekend? What did you get up to?
It was good. Actually, it was a bit random. So I caught up with a bunch of friends. I actually caught up with somebody who I went to high school with. And you know how nowadays it's very easy to keep in touch with people because everyone's on social media. Yeah. This guy just avoided social media like the plague. So we randomly I can't remember how we reconnected, but so I did. I had no frame of reference for what he'd been doing in the past. When did I graduate? 07.
So this is a guy you sort of knew in high school?
Yeah, just like an acquaintance, kind of like a friend of mine in high school. Didn't know what he was doing. Weren't super close in high school. We met up. We had breakfast. It was really cool. But he pulls up in a modified Mazda MX-5. I didn't know he had any interest in cars. And I think, you know, if you have a first generation MX-5, you probably have at least a passing interest in cars. I can't remember how much, brake horsepower he said was at the wheel, but it had been modified quite a bit. And we got to chatting and I told him, well, I ride about cars for a living. But then he also told me that in addition to having this MX-5, he just got rid of a BMW 335i Coupe, which is just like one of my BMWs that I've always been really tempted to get and just kind of never got around to getting. I'm glad I didn't get his specific example because apparently it was a total money pit.
Really?
But it's just really funny, some people are passionate about cars and very vocal about it from a very young age, whereas others seem to be a little bit quieter with their interests or they develop a taste for cars later on. So it's just really funny to talk to someone who I didn't know had any interest in cars, and it turns out he's actually a bit of a gearhead. So I think we'll probably be checking out Cars and Coffee in Brisbane at some point in the near future. So,
what was his reaction when you said you're a motoring journo?
Oh, I don't think he was surprised.
he would have remembered you as that crazy car kid in high school.
Oh, gosh, yes. In high school when I was very committed to the idea of buying for my first car a Ford Taurus Ghia. So very weird car enthusiast is an apt characterization. I did not end up buying one because then I decided I wanted a manual transmission too much. So, and I got a much nicer Ford with a manual. So,
you know what my dream car was when I was a kid?
Oh, God, do tell.
A Morris Minor.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess you don't want to go anywhere very quickly, do you?
No. Except like when as I got older, I still wanted one. So I hit about, 13 or 14, when it was starting to get to the point where Dad was like, okay, if you want a classic car, we should buy one now so we can spend a couple of years restoring it. And then by the time you're 16, you can drive it. I'm like, amazing.
Okay, your dad is awesome, first of all.
Yeah. So and then he was like, okay, I like the sound of a Morris Minor. Let's buy one but put a Datsun 1200 engine in it. I'm like, okay, smart, quicker than I think the Morris Minors had a 1,000cc. I don't know. I'm only going by memory. I don't know a lot about them. But so he's like, yeah, we can do that. We can upgrade it mechanically so it's a little bit better for you and it's, much, much safer doing higher speeds, 80 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, oh, them high speeds, look out.
Yeah. Then we sort of gave up on that when we discovered a Volkswagen Beetle is much cheaper to buy and has much bigger engine options.
And cooler. And looks better.
I think so. Always thought the Morris Minor was a bit of a cutesy car. People think they're ugly.
I saw them as being really dorky because I think what did it for me is they kept manufacturing it for so many years. So by the end, that was classic, whatever it was, the BMC or I can't remember what the name of the overarching corporation was, but they would just really squeeze cars out for a really long time. They made the Maxi for they made the freaking Mini for so long. So, let's get real. They knew how to get the most out of something. But it's cool that you and I had kind of dorky tastes, because I still kind of feel like, I imagine like little Al Borz when he was running around was, Ferrari posters up on the wall. I can't wait to get a WRX STI, and he did. but I never had that kind of like real driving interest in supercars or anything incredibly fast. Granted, I wanted cars a little bit faster than a Morris Minor. So.
Yes.
But, that's the thing about car enthusiasts, right? We come in all different shapes and sizes. We all have strange... guilty pleasures. Lord knows I have a few when it comes to cars. So,
absolutely, yeah.
And look at us now. Look at what you own.
Dream cars. It's sort of cool. And like Genesis, you love Genesis. You have a Genesis. So we're both living the dream, Will.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, time to cover off on this week's news. Will, when I saw the 2022 Genesis G70 shooting brake was revealed, I'm like, bah, it's never coming to Australia. But it is.
But that's where you're wrong, Mandy.
I know.
Third quarter of 2021. So that is, look, I got to be honest, it surprised me too, because Genesis is introducing the GV70, which is a midsize SUV, its first midsize SUV. That's also coming this year. So I have to admit, I was a little surprised to hear that this is coming. So basically, Genesis is launching into the European market finally. And I think the G70 shooting brake, as they call it, even though it is a five-door wagon, I think this is just kind of their proof that they're really taking the European market seriously, because Europe, unlike Australia, unlike the US, they actually still buy wagons. They buy a decent, SUV sales are growing each year there, but there are still some wagons that do really well. The majority of Volkswagen Passats sold there, for example, are wagons. I guess if you want to show that you're taking the European market seriously, a few years ago, you'd have to develop a diesel and introduce a wagon. And nowadays, at least introduce a wagon. G70 shooting brake is coming here. According to the global press materials, they actually say it's the same exterior dimensions as the sedan, but they say the boot is 40% larger. So the sedan actually has a bit of a small boot for the segment. It's got a bit of a small back seat as well. So this should help mitigate that. So that would mean around 472 liters of boot space. And they've also confirmed that the rear seats can be split folded. Sorry. Well, there we go. That's how words are invented, Mandy. I've just saved everybody a lot of time. Don't
just
even worry about editing
that out.
What
you were meaning to say.
The seats can be spalded 40-20-40. otherwise, the cabin is identical to the updated G70 sedan that's coming this year as well. So that includes a new 10.25-inch touchscreen infotainment system. Now, they haven't actually confirmed specifications, but it's likely it will just use the same powertrains as would be found in the sedan. And in fact, the press images that were actually previewed show badging that indicates that this has the 3.3-litre twin-turbo V6 with 272 kilowatts of power and 510 newton meters of torque. So, yeah, she is a goer. There's also the turbocharged 2-litre four-cylinder engine that's also likely to appear in this as well. Otherwise, exterior styling, it's very sleek. Like, this is not a Volvo 240, all right? It's not designed for maximum load carrying capability. It has got a very sleek, rounded rear. I don't know if you remember the first generation Lexus IS. They developed a wagon version of it primarily for the US market called the Sport Cross, I believe. This is very much what this reminds me of, and that is not a bad thing, because I'm really running out of synonyms here. it's very sleek. Looking forward to seeing that here. Look, at the end of the day, this is not going to be a huge seller. It might not even be a huge seller in Europe. They really have to. They've got an uphill battle in Europe, because even Lexus, after all of these years, still is nowhere near the Germans in terms of market share. It's their home turf. Like, what do you expect?
Yeah. So, do we know how many are going to come to Australia?
No. So there's been no sales targets or anything like that released, and I don't think they will release that even at launch because primarily Genesis in Australia is focused on building the brand. I mean, let's not forget they currently still only have one studio open, one dealership open in Australia. So, look, I don't expect it to be a huge seller. I expect the GV70 to soundly outsell it. I actually sent pictures of it to one of my friends in the States because he, my friend that bought the G80.
You've spoken about him before. Yes.
We're Genesis buddies. well, we were friends before we both had Genesises. But he said, I didn't even have to click on the link to know it's not coming here because the US absolutely is not getting it. At least that's not what they've said at this stage. So, yeah, we should count ourselves very lucky that it's actually coming here. And Genesis has said previously, look, anything that's available in right-hand drive, we'll take it. So, look, yeah, looking forward to seeing that.
Snaps to Genesis for bringing it here.
It's, yeah, exactly. Kudos.
Incredible.
Twin Turbo V6 rear-wheel drive wagon, sign me up. I'd love one of these.
Just need a manual stick, but we can live with the auto.
Look, let's not get greedy, Mandy.
Too right. Now, we spoke about this last week, Will, the Ford Mustang Mach 1, how some features that were advertised coming to Australia were not going to be included in the car. Well, Ford have now announced how they're going to make up to those customers.
Yes, this is the opposite of being greedy. So customers that have ordered, good segue, customers have ordered Mustang Mach 1s and then found that features that were advertised and are not there. And it clearly just seems to be a bit of a miscommunication because many of these features, well, not all of them, but some of them, are not even available on Mach 1s in other markets, including in the US. So things like rear parking sensors, the way that the body kit and that is designed for the Mach 1, they're just those features aren't available. But there was another feature that was advertised as coming here that is available in the US market, Mach 1, not coming here. So effectively, and I've seen this, I've had people who have ordered Mustang Mach 1s actually get in contact with me, and I've seen the Facebook group for Mustang Mach 1 owners in Australia. There's a lot of people who have ordered one, and this, look, this ain't cheap, all right? So I can understand why they would be upset. Ford is reaching out to people who have ordered one, just to say, look, okay, we're really sorry. This was a mistake that we made. Here's what we're offering with you. We're offering 3 years of free servicing. So I believe the first three services on the Ford website are listed at $390, $445, and $545. They're also offering a free Ford performance experience. They haven't released full details of that quite yet, but they've said it's a very special experience at the track featuring Ford performance vehicles, a course car ride, and more. They'll be available Australia wide, so it's not like they're just going to only do it in Sydney or something. Now, just gauging, kind of feeling that the temperature of the room, some people are still a little bit unhappy because there was, I believe initially some owners were told, hey, you'll get one free service. I mean, if you're thinking
that's an insult almost, isn't it?
If you think about it, like Ford is charging, oh gosh, how much is it? Well, I mean, I don't want to get the figure wrong. don't want to get any details wrong. Sorry, too soon. So $83,365 before on road costs. So that's around 20 grand more than a GT manual. So people that have ponied out this much money for a pony car, yes, pun intended, are obviously expecting a certain level of features here. And the torsion rear differential that is available in the US market model is not coming here. So it's going to use the same rear diff as the GT. So some people are starting to feel like, okay, well, I'm spending this much more than a GT and maybe I can live without rear parking sensors because it still has a reversing camera. But the torsion rear diff is an advertised performance feature that I was supposed to be getting and I'm not getting it. So we'll have to see. There's still, I mean, the Facebook group is still buzzing with activity. Still a lot of people that are unhappy about it. So it's good that Ford is trying to make up for the mistake that they have made because they have actually had to republished these brochures a couple of times now because I think they actually updated at one point and they didn't update it entirely. So it's just kind of dragged on a little bit. So, yeah, glad Ford is trying to make amends, but we'll see if people are actually happy because at the end of the day, you're spending that much money on a car. If you were that excited because it had this extra performance hardware and you're only getting some of the extra performance hardware, the kind of people that are buying a Mustang Mach 1, I mean, this isn't like a base Outlander, all right? Like people are genuinely like really enthusiastic. They're Mustang aficionados. So let's see.
Mm. Or maybe once they get the car, they might forget about all that sort of stuff, but it's always going to linger in the back of their minds.
Yeah, so, exactly. Especially if you know that those features are available somewhere else, you know, it's the grass is always greener, isn't it? But in that case, the grass is greener. So
true. now the Isuzu MU-X, it's been spotted in Sydney.
Yes. So it is coming here this year, we believe. So it's based on the D-Max, as the outgoing MUX is based on the previous D-Max. So the current D-Max hit Australian showrooms September 1st last year. So we're expecting this MUX to arrive at a very similar point this year. They've also said, Isuzu has also said that there's limited stock available across the MUX range. They think there's going to be enough stock to last until the new model touches down in the third quarter of this year. But as we've seen with cars like the Patrol and the Land Cruiser, people are buying four-wheel drives in droves. And the MUX is very popular with off-roaders, with grey nomads, etc., people who are towing caravans, boats, horse trailers, you know, whatever. Isuzu is offering run-out deals for the outgoing MUX. So they're offering free tow bar wiring kit, electronic brake controller and four-wheel drive variants. So, yeah, if you want a current generation MUX, I'd probably be saying head down to an Isuzu dealership now. If you want to wait, I think it will be worth the wait because much like the current D-Max was just a huge upgrade in terms of technology over the previous one, this one is just basically mirroring those changes. So things like autonomous emergency braking, turn assist, traffic sign recognition, lane keeping assist, blind spot monitoring, rear cross traffic alert, adaptive high beam, those features aren't available on the outgoing MUX. Okay, I'm pretty sure the thing doesn't actually have automatic headlights. So this is a big jump up. In terms of interior, we've seen, I don't know if anybody listening has sat in an old D-Max and sat in a new D-Max. It's like another world.
Two worlds apart.
Yeah, exactly. The current D-Max probably has the nicest interior in the ute segment. So this we've seen the photos have already been released of the interior in its home market of Thailand. So it's going to be a big improvement there. So the MUX also uses the same powertrain as the new D-Max. So a 3-litre turbo diesel four-cylinder with 140 kilowatts of power and 450 newton metres of torque. So it stacks up pretty well against the likes of the Mitsubishi Pajero Sport, Toyota Fortuner, etc. It's definitely a more upmarket, more technology packed SUV than the current car, even down to the infotainment, a 9-inch infotainment system with wireless Apple CarPlay and wired Android Auto. Look, we expect the price is probably going to go up a bit, just like it did with the D-Max. But you'll certainly be getting a lot more kit for your money. And I'm curious to hear what you think, because now I haven't seen it in person yet. I wasn't on that street in Sydney. But one kind of trap I think these ute-based SUVs fall into is they always end up looking really tall and really narrow.
Yes.
So they look dorky, like, to be honest.
Yeah. This one doesn't, though, does it?
It doesn't. Maybe it's just a very flattering angle. It's, you know, like when you hold your phone up really well, so just, you know, not the MySpace angle. Maybe this is a great angle for it, but I'll have to reserve judgment for when I see it in person. But it looks, it looks almost kind of crossover-y.
It does. It doesn't look like that they've used a ute and then put a back on it and sort of left it at that. It looks completely different. So,
yeah, exactly. It doesn't look like a Fortuner.
It does.
Yeah. So that's good. But yeah, look, right now the MUX, in terms of your body on frame, large SUVs, pretty sure the only thing outselling it at the moment is the Prado. So this does better than even the Pajero Sport. It certainly does better than the Fortuner. It's, I believe it generally outsells the Ford Everest as well. So we've seen that the D-Max has been very successful, the new D-Max. So I fully expect, unless the pricing is just massively more expensive, I expect this to do well, because Isuzu, Australia has really kind of burnished its reputation. So yeah, let's see, but won't have to wait long because it'll be here this year.
Yeah, well, you imagine that it would start to sell out quite well, considering people are struggling to get their hands on Prados at the moment to tow caravans and that the like. So it could be perfect timing for Isuzu to be introducing the new MUX.
And I don't think they'll have any trouble selling the old one either, because at the end of the day, it's Isuzu has acquired this reputation for just being, you know, well screwed together, reliable. So look, they won't have any problems selling what's left.
Absolutely. Speaking of what's left, and another SUV, the 2022 Mitsubishi Pajero Final Edition. We have details for this. We are bidding farewell to the Pajero, but the Pajero Sport's hanging around though, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Pajero Sport is sticking around. So if you want a rugged Mitsubishi SUV, that's going to be your only choice moving forward. So the Pajero Sport is a body-on-frame SUV that's based on the Triton, whereas the Pajero is its own thing. It's actually a unibody construction. But basically, the Pajero has been on sale for, around 40 years.
Decades.
Yeah, exactly, decades. Now, the current one isn't quite that old, but it is old. It debuted in 2006, and it's actually, it's closely related to the generation that was introduced in 1999. So, it is old. It's still selling, but Mitsubishi is actually closing the factory that has made Pajero since day dot. And to celebrate the end of the Pajero, or I guess to mourn its passing, or to commemorate, there we go, that's the better verb.
Passing.
to commemorate the end of the Pajero, they're introducing final edition models. So just 800 are going to be offered. Now, it's not like one spec with everything. Basically, it's a badge. The final edition is like a badge, a range of extras that's being applied to the entire Pajero range. So if you get a final edition model, you're going to get a badge, a tinted bonnet protector, a leather compendium for your documents, carpet mats, a rubber boot, cargo liner, and a fold-out boot flap. So it's kind of like one of those kind of classic special editions. All that's missing is like a decal on the side. but look, I think there's a lot of people. Pajero has got so much heritage, and there's a lot of loyal Pajero buyers that the thing still, you know, sells to a decent degree in Australia. So I think there'll probably be some people that'll be like, oh yeah, I'd love to get a final edition. I've always had Pajeros. Mitsubishi's calling it a 2022 model. The cars are actually built in March and they're identical to the 2021. So I'm not sure why they're doing that. But
to make it sound more current.
I guess it's just, is it like when you just squeeze out a few more episodes of a TV show and then it can be syndicated? Yes. So it's just one more year and there we go. Pajero reruns forever. Unfortunately, there's still been no plans to replace the Pajero with anything, because I think a lot of people speculate, oh, well, they could just slap Mitsubishi badges on a Patrol, or, you know, or re-engineer a Patrol or something like that. But nothing of the sort has been announced. So if you want an OG Pajero, this is your last chance. So it's got a 3.2 litre turbo diesel 4-cylinder, a 5-speed automatic. Yeah, remember those?
Wow.
And Mitsubishi Super Select 2 4-wheel drive system. So prices are start at $54,990 before on-road costs for the GLX Final Edition. And if you want the one with all the fruit, $63,490 before on-roads gets you the Exceed Final Edition. So, yeah, nice. then it'll be farewell Pajero.
Aw, sad times. But, hey, we've got the Pajero Sport still here. So it's,
there we go, yeah.
Its cousin is hanging around, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
hit the car news link at carexpert.com.au if you'd like to know more. Mike Costello, welcome.
Hello, guys.
You've spent some time behind the wheel of the flagship Nissan Navara, the Pro 4X. What's so special about the Pro 4X?
Well, I should say flagship for now, because there is an even more flagshipy one coming soon, which is
Warrior.
Going to be called the Warrior. So the second iteration of the Prem car engineered right here in Melbourne, Navara, Pro 4X Warrior. Fairly clunky name. But anyhow, I'm digressing. Yeah, so the Pro 4X, basically, Nissan a few months ago revealed the Series 5 D23 Navara, which introduced a bunch of updates just to kind of contemporize that car, some more sound deadening, a stronger rear axle, new steering wheel design, which is well overdue because the old one was shocking, more active safety tech, butcher new design, new headlights and a much more upmarket grille. The Pro 4X is the top of the top of the top of the pops of that range. So it's got this awesome black steel sports bar in the tub with a sail plane. It's got black steps, black wheels. They've swapped out the Toyo road tires for Yokohama all-terrains, some interesting seats with specific stitching, you know, your typical sticker pack, black alloy fenders. Now, it's really very much a tough-looking package aside from those all-terrain tires. It doesn't get bash plates over and above what the standard one gets. You don't get rescue hooks over and above what the standard one gets. No suspension work or anything like that. All that stuff will be part of the Warrior program. They had to leave a little bit of space. So this is really kind of like a Ford Ranger Wildtrak, I suppose. And in that sense, it does a great job because it actually makes the Navara quite desirable. Finally, that D23 looks like the tough truck it always had to look like. It's got this great stealth grey light paintwork with all the black stuff on the outside. It looks tough, turns heads. You drive past a building site and all the tradies check it out and want to ask you questions. In terms of price, well, it wears a drive-away price of $62,790 for the auto. That's based on a $6,630 list price. So that stacks up okay in the class. A Hilux SR5 with a premium pack will be $67,000 and a Ranger Wildtrak $68,500. So it's cheaper than the two top sellers. But then again, it is more expensive than an Isuzu D-Max X-Terrain, which is quite a spiritually and conceptually similar vehicle, and certainly more expensive than a Triton GSR. And it's about the same as an Amarok V6 Highline. So look, in terms of price, I still think Nissan's probably just a little bit up there. It should probably be closer to the Triton than to the Amaroks and the D-Maxes of the world. But then again, we all know that these cars are bought as tax write-offs and you can get ABN deals and things like that. No mechanical changes to the 140 kilowatt 2.3 litre twin turbo diesel. So really, this is just something that it looks the part based on the STX.
How does it stack up equipment-wise with its rivals?
Yeah, so it's super well equipped being the top of the range model. So it's got all those add-ons that I mentioned earlier. In the tub, you've got a really high quality tub liner, not some cheap and crappy one, but it's a nice plastic tub liner that's properly sealed off with the utility track system of tracks running along the side of the tub with movable tie down lash points, fixed D-rings. You've got a counterbalance tailgate that you can lift up and with a pinky if you need to. So really good in the tub there. Inside, you've got a heap of luxury features, leather accent, tinted seats, although manual adjustment and no heating, which is a bit strange. Carpet floor mats, auto-dimming rearview mirror, dual-zone climate control, button start and proximity key. The infotainment's quite good, 8-inch screen, a bit smaller than the class leaders, but does the job. Great sat-nav system with good voice control, phone mirroring, digital radio and a 360-degree camera, which is a bit fuzzy, but still a good thing to have. It's even got a USB-C point in there. They've also fitted a new digital instrument cluster, or a part digital instrument cluster, I should say, which is quite good. On the outside, LED headlights, taillights and DRLs, reverse sensors, that really cool sliding rear window, and the Navara is the only pickup that actually has that now. Proximity key, rain sensing wipers and privacy glass. So it's lacking for nothing. It's got all the active safety tech now too, which is quite important. So AEB, blind spot monitoring, lane departure alert, although it doesn't have steering assist for the lane departure to keep you in the lane because it's got a hydraulically assisted steering system rather than a motor-driven one, cross-traffic alert and a tyre pressure gauge. I'd love to see active cruise control fitted. That remains off the cards, but otherwise certainly better equipped than the Navaras that came before it.
How does it drive on freeways or highways?
Yeah, so the Navara's strong points continue. So the refinement of this thing is excellent. A couple of decibels quieter over my test road than either the BT50 or the D-Max or the Ranger that I drove recently. So in terms of refinement, it's great. The engine only really gets gruff when you're up it.
10 seconds 0 to 100 time is about what you'd expect. It's actually got a little bit more tyre sidewall than the STX, so its ride quality is great. And we all know the Navara has that 5-link rear suspension with coils, which means it settles quickly and it doesn't get thrown all over the place by mid-corner hits like a traditional leaf-sprung ute would. The dual-rate rear springs are excellent. The Navara actually likes carrying loads now, whereas the previous iterations weren't so good at that. One-ton payload, unlike a lot of these show ponies that can't lug a ton, and it does it fine. The way the two-rate springs work is that they change the way they work depending on how much load you have over and above it. So drives really well. The steering is quite weighty. You find with a lot of utes now, like Ranger and D-Max, have got really light, almost video gamey steering, very highly assisted, whereas the Navara still has a bit of heft, which a lot of people like. I think it's a pretty underrated machine to drive. When they first launched the D23 five or six years ago, it was a very flawed car, but Nissan has continually updated it, strengthening the chassis, changing the springs, changing the steering rack, doing all these things to it, and they've finally got it to the place now where, to be honest with you, it should have been 6 years ago, but at least they got there in the end, you know? So I think, you know, if I was to kind of summarize this car, we know that a lot of people buy dual cab utes now as sort of second family cars, as almost SUVs with tubs. And the Navara does that particularly well. I don't think it's necessarily still quite the class leader, but it's definitely the best of the D23s that I've driven by some margin. Looks the part, really comfortable, quite refined, decent engine performance. If you're looking into one, I would say that you're on the right track and that it's a good thing. I'd probably still urge someone to have a look at the Isuzu D-Max X-Terrain before it, but definitely a lot better than it was before. And as that second family car lifestyle truck, it does a pretty good job.
Yeah, fantastic. You can check out the review at the site now. Moko, while you're here, we may as well talk about your review of the Haval H6. It looks good. It's got more equipment.
Well, the question that most people will be asking is, what the hell is a Haval?
True.
No one. So Haval is a subsidiary of GWM, or Great Wall Motors. So it's Chinese. It's based in a city called Baoding, although it has a design center in near Shanghai. And they've done that thing that Chinese brands do, which is poached people from existing brands. They've poached a former chief designer of Land Rover who did the Velar to do the new SUVs. They've spent about $3.5 billion on R&D. They've poached a bunch of BMW and Volkswagen drivetrain engineers just to try and really speed up the development and advancement of the brand. Haval has been around for a while, and it hasn't really knock the nail on the head as far as sales go in its few years on the market. The old H6 looked okay. It had a little bit of Range Rover Evoque about its design, but it just kind of fell between the cracks, you know. But we live in an age now where MG is killing it, and most of the existing legacy brands have jacked up their prices. So there's obviously a massive gap in the market for a affordable competitor, even if the brand isn't very well known. And that's where the H6 comes in. So this is an X-Trail Outlander RAV4-sized car. So it's a mid-sized SUV. The base price is $39.90 drive away, and the top price is $38.990 drive away. But I had the mid-spec one, which is called the Lux, $33.990 drive away, which means it's about the same price as a base model, absolute base stripper, rental spec X-Trail or Outlander or Kia Sportage, and about $6,000 or $7,000 cheaper than the very cheapest RAV4 you can get, and is about on par with the MG HS in equivalent spec. But this thing comes absolutely loaded with equipment. For $34,000, 18-inch wheels, rain sensing wipers, LED headlights and tail lights, you've got button start, two 10.25-inch screens, one for instrumentation, one for the touch screen. Apple CarPlay, Android Auto is coming. Roof rails, privacy glass, fake leather seats, a 360 camera, and it is the best 360 camera on anything this side of a Mercedes-Benz. The resolution of this thing is amazing. Let's not forget that all this tech is made in China anyway, right? So it's hardly a disadvantage. Active cruise control, dual zone climate control, and the works. If you step up to the top of the range one, you get stuff like a 12-inch touchscreen, auto parking assist, a head-up display, mood lighting, heated and ventilated seats, a sunroof, you name it. So this thing is absolutely loaded to the gills, irrespective of how much you spend. That's really where these new upstart brands can kind of get a gap in the market, because for the same price as a Boggo Outlander or X-Trail that's got very little in it, you've got this car that's less well-known but is loaded with features. And then when it comes to the active safety stuff, it's actually got the Mobile IQ 4 autonomous driving chip. So 14 radars, 5 cameras, And the self-driving stuff is actually pretty good. So secondary collision mitigation, maneuver emergency braking, active cruise control, lane keeping by steering aid with lane tracing control, blind spot monitoring, cross-traffic alert, AEB for pedestrian, cyclist, and at junctions. I mean, this thing is not missing much. Doesn't have an ANCAP crash test yet, which needs to happen sooner rather than later because I won't recommend a car without it. But in terms of price versus features equation, yeah, this thing really stacks up.
how well do those features work, like the lane keep assist and blind spot, all those sort of things?
For the most part, really, really well. It's got one system where it slows the car down. So when the cameras and radar sense a corner coming up, it slows the car down. It's a bit conservative. It slows it down far too much, more than I would like it to. It's sort of whatever AI is controlling the car has the personality of an 85-year-old, you know. It's a little bit too slow to react. So a bit of calibration is probably needed to get it just right. But the features are great. But moreover, it's actually the quality of this thing. This, to me, feels half a generation ahead of the MGs. I think the MG HS has a great look, great brand. People have heard the name before. But the Havel stuff feels like it's maybe a year or two ahead, actually. The wheel is wrapped in really good quality leather. The build quality feels great. It looks really contemporary and modern. There's quite a bit of Peugeot in the way the interior design looks. And it's built as well as anything out of Japan or Korea. Like, you know, you do the old classic test of trying to shake the transmission tunnel or touching different, you know, touch points and services for tactility tests and things like that. And it's really built as well as anything out of any other Asian country.
So that's one thing I noticed about the MG HS. Yeah, it drives well enough. It looks good inside and out. But the infotainment really needs work. The safety technology still needs finessing. So
yep.
So what you're saying is the Havel H6 actually feels much more finessed in those areas.
Yeah. Well, you know how the MG does that thing where it beeps and chimes at you all the time?
Incessantly.
Just a few lines of code are all it needs to not do that anymore. Well, the Havel doesn't do any of that, for an example. So that stuff works really well. The infotainment is really simple, really easy to work out. It swipes and zooms and pinches just like a smartphone does. And it all works. And it doesn't have Mandarin font on it. And it doesn't have weird mangling of language and strange menus. And these sorts of little quirks that we used to see on these cars aren't there anymore. I mean, this feels very, very contemporary.
So, Moko, what's under the bonnet and how does it drive?
Right. So it runs an in-house developed 2-litre turbo petrol with 150 kilowatts of power and 320 newton metres of torque, which really puts the HS, or the MG, I should say, the Outlander and the X-Trail in the shade. None of them can compete with those kind of power and torque figures. It's right up there with the best in the class. It's front-wheel drive only at this spec grade. Only the top-of-the-range one comes with an on-demand all-wheel drive system, which is a bit of a shame because sometimes the power actually overwhelms the front wheels. I was doing sub-8 seconds 0 to 100 times in this thing, which is pretty snappy. And the dual-clutch gearbox, which again was developed in-house, is actually relatively good. It's still at low speeds. You get those quirks that all DCTs have, and I would prefer a CVT even or a torque converter for a typical soccer mum car like this, but it's better than many transmissions of the type. But yeah, that torque does overcome the front wheels from time to time. I noticed a bit of chirping and slipping, and I would have liked all-wheel drive to at least be available on the mid-spec, but you know what? It's definitely not under-engine.
There are turbo 2 litres in this segment. I think the Ford Escape is one that comes to mind that put out more power and I believe more torque as well. So I'm just wondering, how is the fuel economy of this in comparison to rivals?
Yeah, not bad. So the claim is 7.4. Now, my highway test was 7.1 and my mixed cycle route was 8.5. And that was a genuine mixed cycle route. That wasn't me feathering it or anything like that. So not too bad, actually, in terms of fuel use. Again, I'd like all-wheel drive to be available, but other than that, not too many complaints about the drivetrain. It actually drives relatively well too. There are some caveats. It sits on a new platform, a new modular stretchable architecture, which is what we're seeing all brands doing these days. Ooh. So a new electric assisted steering, independent suspension at both ends, a lot of Bosch, you know, ESP systems and mechanicals like that. Super strong steel, ultra high tensile steel compared to the old one. Its decibel test was quieter than a Honda CR-V that I drove at the same time. In terms of, you know, ride, it's actually pretty good. It lopes quite nicely. The steering is nice nicely weighted. The only real downside dynamically was it's very loud over sharp hits. You go over a speed bump a bit too quickly, and it doesn't, the body control isn't wayward, and it's not horrific, but it's very loud. There's not enough sound deadening going on in the suspension. So that might scare people. If they go over a bump and they hear a crash or a thump, they might not know what it is. It's not hurting the car. It's just a bit unrefined. So I would encourage Haval to really work on that. But other than that, you know, it drives 95% as good as it really needs to, which means it's come a heck of a long way over a lot of the cheap and cheerful cars that Haval used to offer. And I remember being on the original Haval H6 launch a few years ago, and there were so many quirks with that car. It was 75% sound with just a bunch of little weird things that it would do. You know, you'd put the brakes on and it would flash the hazards for no reason, and all the active safety systems would ping and chime for no apparent reasons, and the ESC was really badly calibrated, and there were all these little quirks, and they've really ironed a lot of those out with this car. So I think they've done a pretty good job. And then, as you said, Mandy, it looks tough. It's big, it's RAV4 sized and cheap as chips. Plus, comes with a 7-year warranty. So,
wow.
You know, Haval's backing it up with a long factory warranty. Again, there are going to be a lot of people who, and I'm probably falling into this group, who are going to say, you know what, I'm going to get an Outlander or an X-Trail because it doesn't have as much stuff in it, but it's a brand I know and trust, and Haval doesn't have the runs on the board yet, and it's entirely understandable. But if you're the sort of person that goes, you know what, I'm prepared to take a punt, value for money is the number one thing in my mind, I don't really care about brand equity and, you know, brand legacy and all things like that, this car really makes a lot of sense. And we've seen MG's, you know, sales skyrocket to the point where it's in the top 10 of all car brands in Australia now, and sales growing double digits year on year. And I don't see any reason why Haval doesn't deserve to do the same thing, because its products actually strike me as even better.
Wow, that's a really big statement there, Moco. If you would like to read more information about the Haval H6, you can head to carexpert.com.au. Good review. Thanks, Moco.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure.
The man with the fancy fashion and fancy hair got the chance to drive a pretty fancy car last week. Hello, J-Wo.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting that introduction. Hi, guys. How are you?
Well, it's true, right? You like to take pride in your appearance.
I try to match the vibe of whatever I'm taking a photo with. So
you do it very, very well, because I saw some photos on your social of standing next to a Bentley Bentayga. You're at the launch.
Yes.
I'm assuming you've never had a chance to I think you've driven maybe one of these but never reviewed one. What was the experience like?
Well, I actually have never driven a Bentley before this launch. Oh. So I think on my first day at my first journalism job, you can all guess where that was, Paul actually took me out in a Continental convertible on my first day, which is a really cool experience. It's not a bad way to start, but I've never actually driven one myself. So it was quite exciting for me because I love all the British brands. I've had a bit of a connection with all of them growing up as a young car fan. So to get to something at the higher end of the scale, like a Bentley, was a really cool just to be there and to actually touch and feel something that's so expensive and so desirable, was really, really cool. So it was definitely a different experience for me as a launch. Yeah.
Yeah. Where was the launch?
It was at the, I forget how to say it, it's like the Mornong or Morlong Estate in Mickleham, which is like past Tullamarine and north in
Victoria.
Victoria's north. Yeah. So it's like a 45-minute drive or something. This beautiful, beautiful winery and estate. Yeah. They have a lovely restaurant. We had a wonderful food for dinner. We drove Bentleys for about an hour each.
What sort of roads did you take it on?
So it was quite an interesting mix. It sort of had that like country B road vibe about it. So there was a few bits that were a bit more well paved and marked and all that kind of stuff and quite straight. And then there were some more undulating, like pothole mark sections that were really good for testing out the ride and the sound insulation, because you've got a mix of road surfaces, all that kind of stuff. But the route was a little bit short. It's not the sort of drive route that you'd... Yeah, it was like a 45-minute test loop. But the thing is that with cars like this, they obviously have limited access to a vehicle that expensive, so you can't really put too many Ks on it because they have to sell it at some point. So,
yeah. What are the differences between the older Bentayga and the current one now?
So it's a facelift, but it's a pretty significant refresh. So the entire exterior has been changed and the interior has been heavily revised as well. So you get a completely new look on the exterior, which is more in line with the new Continental and Flying Spur. So you get like they describe it a certain way, but it's hard for me to even put into words because the old one was very square and bluff and this one has a few more curves about it. It's a little more dynamic looking, but it's still instantly recognizable as a Bentley and as a Bentayga because the overall shape is sort of still there, but it's more the lines and the curves are a little bit different. And then it's had quite a comprehensive technology upgrade inside. So it's not a secret that the Bentayga shares its mechanicals and, you know, electrical architecture with stuff like the Audi Q7 and the Volkswagen Touareg. So the original one, I think, had an infotainment system out of the old Volkswagen Touareg, which is a little bit behind, especially now as some of the platform mates have moved on a bit in terms of their tech. So now you get like a Bentley's version of the virtual cockpit display. You get a new larger touchscreen infotainment system with wireless Apple CarPlay. They've got wireless phone charging and a few ergonomic changes. So they've revised the back seat so that it's got more leg room and there's just more convenience features in there as well that bring it more in line with the latest that other brands can offer, because Bentley likes to claim that they pioneered the luxury SUV segment, as in the high-end luxury stuff. So they sort of class Audi and Mercedes and Porsche as premium brands, whereas Bentley sort of sees itself as a proper luxury brand to go up against the likes of, you know, Rolls-Royce with the Cullinan or Lamborghini with the Urus. So yeah, they went through quite a lot of changes. Even if they might seem small, there's quite a bit going on there, yeah.
Do we have prices out for it yet?
Yeah, so the base Bentayga V8, and I use the term base very loosely, is about $368,000 plus on-road costs and before options. And if you go onto any sort of website that details options and pricing, there's a very long list, and some of the prices on that list are very, very big. One of the options is actually something that they call the Touring specification, which is basically a driver assistance pack. So it comes as standard with a few of, like, you know, your low speed autonomous emergency braking and rear cross traffic alert as standard equipment. But to get stuff like adaptive cruise control on the standard car, you actually have to pay about $16,000 for an option pack.
What?
Which gets you, yeah, it gets you like adaptive cruise control with traffic jam assist and like a high-speed autonomous emergency braking and a couple of other things in there, which you'd think should be standard, but
it should be.
It is what it is. So it's $368,000, give or take, for the base car. And then they're also launching with a very limited run of first edition models. So that specification is like another $86,000 over the standard car, but that includes stuff like the Touring specification. There's like the Mulliner driving specification, which Mulliner is like their coach building division. So there's a few like high-end exclusive trim options there. You get like special wheels and different trimmings and things like that. So it's the pricing for cars like this, it's not the same as what you would expect from even like a premium or mainstream brand. There's so many different ways that you can price these cars up purely based on what you option it with, because they're meant to be sort of tailored and crafted per se, you know, exclusively for the customer. The car's meant to tailor around you. So all of the pricing and options and things like that's all very dependent on what you want in the vehicle.
So we know that the Bentayga shares a bit under the skin with other SUVs in the Volkswagen Group family, but how does it feel to drive? Does it feel like any other Volkswagen Group SUV?
It doesn't. So there's a lot of work's obviously gone into like sound insulation and stuff, because Bentley prides itself on having that kind of cabin. It wasn't whisper quiet as I would have expected. I think the car that I had those silly 22 or 23 inch rims on it with like licorice thin tires. So there was a little bit of, you could just sort of hear it on certain surfaces. It was never like loud or intrusive or anything, but it was sort of like there. And in my mind, I was like, I don't want to hear anything. So there was, there was that. And it definitely feels a bit bigger than the other vehicles on that platform that I've driven. It's like, I've got the the specs here somewhere. So let me find the dimensions. So it's 5.1 meters long and 2 meters wide. So it's on the larger side of things. It's a big car, and it's also very heavy. It's like 2.4 tons. So it definitely feels its size and weight. And Bentley bills it as like the fastest luxury SUV, and fastest would translate to top speed, because if you get it with the W12, it does like 320 Ks an hour, which is ridiculous. The V8 can do 290, which in Australia means absolutely nothing, because you'll never find a road that you'll be able to do that on.
It hasn't been limited to 250 like all other cars?
No, really? I think that's something that those high-end brands do, particularly Bentley. I think people like to have the idea of going that fast on like an Autobahn or an Autopista or whatever.
But Australia, you can boast about it. That's all you can do.
Well, yeah, if you're able to drive through the outback at that time, there was that de-restricted section of highway that might have helped. But
hit something anyway.
Yeah. It definitely feels its size and weight, which in itself is a little bit different to some of the other cars on the platform. I think because it feels so heavy and like very almost boaty, the steering's very numb. So because it's so large, you sort of turn and you're like waiting for it to sort of respond and do what you want it to do, because you have to let the weight shift. But it's got that 48-volt active anti-roll system, which Bentley sort of pioneered for the rest of that platform, because now you can get it in the other cars, but that sort of keeps it nice and flat through corners. And maybe that also has a weird sensation when the vehicle's that large, because you're expecting a little bit of lean, but you're not moving. So that's something to get used to. And also because it feels so big and heavy, the fact that it can accelerate so hard and so aggressively without making that much noise, because it's obviously quite muted in the cabin, it's just a really, for me personally, a bit of an odd sensation. Like it's very much a GT. Guess if you're looking within that group of vehicles and you're like, you know, I want something that's like the sharpest, maybe you'd look at the Lambo, because that's been specifically designed for track use. It's a little bit faster, a little bit smaller, sharper, whatever. Whereas this one, like you could sit in this car for hours. I would happily drive from Melbourne to Sydney in one of these, and you could do it probably without stopping, because it lacks is a toilet in it. It's got everything else.
Next year, Bentley, next year.
Yeah, it's just a really comfy, quiet, relaxing thing to drive. And then if you're feeling a little bit cheeky, you can bury your right foot, and then before you know it, you're already doing the speed limit. So in the limited driving that we had, I did have a bit of fun, because it's got so much power that you can sort of play around with it, play with the paddle shifters, or put into sports mode, then change it into, it has like a Bentley mode, which I think is like a grand touring sort of mode. So it must have a softer suspension, but like more sharper throttle response. And then in comfort mode, it is genuinely so wafty and comfortable. It's on air suspension, so that helps. But it's just a kind of a, for me personally, it was kind of a weird experience, because I didn't really know what to expect, and I didn't really know how to feel about it afterwards, because it was obviously really cool and, you know, it was a bit of fun, but you can't look at these kind of vehicles as a value thing, because, you know, you don't buy a Louis Vuitton handbag being like, oh, it's so much better value than the Prada one. But you know what I mean? It's like it's a designer product. So I have to keep on remembering that, you know, at $370,000, no, this isn't cheap. This isn't your typical family car. But for you think of the kind of person that would buy this, A, they're probably just like, I want the Bentley SUV. They're probably not cross shopping with anything. But what it does is it does, you know, you look at it, it's stunning in its own way. It's not like a classically beautiful form, but it's got this sort of, you know, stance and
got a presence.
That presence about it. You look at it and you're like, wow, that's a Bentley. And then, you know, it's got the huge grille, the massive wheels, the huge haunches and the creases in the bodywork, the crystal headlights, which look stunning when they're turned on. And then you get inside the cabin and there's probably about 8 cows worth of leather in there, and because everything is in leather. It's crazy. And like the really high grade smooth stuff too. There's none of this fake grain stuff, and there's, you know, wood veneer. You can get carbon. The car that I had this interesting like alloy finish with like diamonds through it. diamond shapes, not actual diamonds, because that would be crazy.
I wouldn't be surprised though.
Yeah, but yeah, and the amount of customization that you have with this stuff, there's like 80 different color options that you can have, plus you can create your own if you really want to. The country manager for Bentley, I was speaking to him about some of the personalization options that they offer and also the kind of stories that they have. And you know, you can base, they've had people come in and be like, this is my favorite nail polish color. I want my car in this color. Or they've brought in an item of clothing or something like that. So you really can, it's like a, you know, a tailored designer suit. You can basically make of it what you, make it what you want.
Well, I spoke to somebody at Rolls-Royce who said a similar thing, except somebody brought in some kind of vegetable or something, because they, I believe they were a farmer or had some kind of association with them. They're like, we want a car that matches this, the color of this vegetable. So it's fascinating what they'll do if you have the money.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you're spending that much, you may as well.
Well, exactly right. And you can also commission colors that from other manufacturers' palettes. So, you know, you'll get people asking for like a Porsche or an Audi or a, you know, a McLaren color and things like that. There are some really cool things that you can do with those cars. It just obviously comes at a massive price. And also you can option it as a 4, 5, and 7 seater. So you can either have it as like a high riding limousine. You can have it as a standard 5-seat SUV, or you can have it as a 7-seat family car. So there's a level of versatility there that is quite, you know, it's an appealing prospect, I guess, but it's not anything that other manufacturers don't offer for less or similar money. So it's kind of like a, you know, it's a passion purchase. It's a luxury item. It's not something that you have to, that you really think about with your head. I feel it's more of a, you know, heart purchase.
Yeah. And you're right about, you know, comparing, Louis Vuitton and Prada handbags, because, ultimately, somebody is going to say, I want this, or they're going to say, I want a Rolls-Royce Cullinan. And you're not going to be able to convince them either way.
Yeah, pretty much. So I think that's the thing. It's so brand-led, and the customers are passionate about the brand, the image that goes with it. So it's from a review perspective, you can obviously be very objective with the performance, or, you know, I'm probably going to say you probably shouldn't have to pay $17,000 to have adaptive cruise control in a family SUV. But at the same time, I'm in no way the target customer or the kind of person that would buy this vehicle. So there's plenty of people that will go in there and be like, yeah, I want that. And to them, $16,000 is probably, you know, my idea of a Big Mac meal at, you know, in terms of the ratio of income to expense. So look, I really enjoyed the experience of, you know, driving the vehicle, being able to really poke and prod around and get an experience what that level of luxury and high-end motoring is. I'll probably enjoy writing the review, because I reckon I'll have an interesting perspective on it.
Yeah, definitely. Just before you go, Joe, I wanted to ask you this question, just a nice short one. What was your favorite feature or option of the Bentayga?
That's a really hard question. The key is pretty cool. It's got this really big, thick, heavy key that looks really nice. And I think the knurled switchgear is a really cool point of difference. That's something that Bentley is really well known for. The cabin's sort of like a weird mix of Audi buttons and then like Bentley everything else. So like you get all the Bentley fonts and everything, but you get the wood or the gloss black or the carbon veneers and like the quilted leather everywhere. Like I'm a sucker for quilted leather. And like everything, they've done enough to sort of make it a Bentley thing, even if it's masking its origins. So I think in terms of like the option or feature is probably irrelevant. It's more just like the presence and the emotion it gets out of you when you look at it and sit in it, that just makes you feel like a boss. it makes you feel rich and successful. So
and yeah, something, I think that's something to remember as well. The smell. The last time I was in a Bentley, I was absolutely blown away by how phenomenal it smelt inside.
Well, so, I don't think vegans would agree with you, but yes.
Well, no, it does, I know. I'm wearing a leather jacket right now. I wish you could get this kind of smell and texture from something grown in the lab, but until then, unfortunately, this is what happens.
But it was just a really cool experience, so really glad that I got the opportunity to do so.
Good stuff. Looking forward to reading that review. Is at carexpert.com.au. Thank you very much, James Wong.
Thanks, guys.
Well, this has been fun, Will. We should do it more often.
Oh, yes. Every week, yeah. Sound good?
Oh, totally. The Will and Mandy car podcast. Something like that. Probably should put Car Expert in there somewhere.
Oh, yeah, true. No, it's a fun little spin-off. It's just building the brand. It's like, oh, there's another Law and Order coming out.
Yes. Mm. Now, business time. Some events and launches and the cars we've got coming up next week.
Yes. She asked politely. So, Kia Niro launch. So for those who aren't familiar with the Kia Niro, think of it as like a Kia's kind of crossover equivalent to the Hyundai Ioniq. So it's going to come here with hybrid, plug-in hybrid and full electric versions. Then James is actually going to be in Sydney to drive the new Volkswagen Tiguan. So that's exciting. In terms of cars, if I take a look at our calendar, we're still going through some Peugeots. Actually, funnily enough, we had a five.
Still.
No, I'm not complaining. I had a 5008 GT up in Brisbane, and then I flew down here to Melbourne, and I got into a 5008 GT.
Which, oh, no way.
No, the idea was obviously to get all of us across Peugeot's SUV range, but I've actually driven it a little bit more myself, so it's nice to spend a little bit more time with a car because sometimes, you know, the amount of time you have with one feels a little bit too short, like visiting a cool city. So we've got a Peugeot 2008 GT Sport in Melbourne next week. James's Tiguan is a 162 TSI R-Line, if you're wondering, which sounds lovely. If I didn't already mention the Niro, we have got in Melbourne a Toyota Prado Kakadu and a Ford Everest Titanium.
Sounds like a bit of a comparison.
Yes, exactly. All that's missing is a Pajero Sport Exceed and whatever the top spec MUX is that doesn't have automatic headlights.
Yes.
Not yet, but it will. That is what we have got in our garage next week.
Another busy week coming up indeed. Now, if you would like to shoot us an email, if you have any questions or any feedback for us, you can shoot us a message at podcast@carexpert.com.au. William Stopford, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mandy, and I hope you've enjoyed the Will and Mandy podcast show featuring special guests.